Not everything that can be counted counts, and not everything that counts can be counted. Welcome to A Walk Within, a show where we visit a fairy tale or a fable from around the world and revisit life experiences invoked by it to explore the parallels between the two and find newer meanings. I'm Anoop, and in this final part of the mini-series of a Japanese fairy tale by Yei Theodora Ozaki, we will rejoin Sentaro in the country of perpetual life, as well as three aspiring company secretaries in Indore. But before we start, here is a quick summary of the story so far. In Japan, a financially comfortable man named Sentaro did not wish to die. This desire led him to search for hermits who had the elixir of life and Jofuku, who is their god. He did manage to find him, but instead, Jofuku offered him to send him to the country of perpetual life. Sentaro found this country's residents to be little unique in their desire to grow old and die. Sentaro settled in the country regardless. The story continues once we are back. As years went by, however, things did not go as smoothly as at first. He had heavy losses in business, and several times some affair went wrong with his neighbors. This caused him great annoyance. Time passed like the flight of an arrow for him, for he was busy from morning till night. 300 years went by in this monotonous way, and then at last he began to grow tired of his life in this country, and he longed to see his own land and his old home. However long he lived here, life would always be the same. So was it not foolish and wearisome to stay here forever? Sentaro, in his wish to escape from the country of perpetual life, recollected Jofuku, who had helped him before when he was wishing to escape from death, and he prayed to the saint to bring him back to his own land again. No sooner did he pray than the paper crane popped out of his pocket. Sentaro was amazed to see that it had remained undamaged after all these years. Once more, the bird grew and grew till it was large enough for him to mount it. As he did so, the bird spread its wing and flew swiftly out across the sea in the direction of Japan. Such was the willfulness of the man's nature that he looked back and regretted all he had left behind. He tried to stop the bird in vain. The crane held on its way for thousands of miles across the ocean. Then a storm came on, and the wonderful paper crane got damp, crumpled up, and fell into the sea. Sentaro fell with it. Very much frightened at the thought of being drowned, he cried out loudly to Jofuku to save him. He looked around, but there was no ship in sight. He swallowed a quantity of seawater, which only increased his miserable plight. While he was thus struggling to keep himself afloat, he saw a monstrous shark swimming towards him. As it came nearer, it opened its huge mouth, ready to devour him. Sentaro was all but paralyzed with the fear now that he felt his end so near, and screamed out as loudly as ever he could to Jofuku to come and rescue him. Lo and behold, Sentaro was awakened by his own screams to find that during his long prayer he had fallen asleep before the shrine, and that all his extraordinary and frightful adventure had been only a wild dream. He was in a cold perspiration with fright and utterly bewildered. Suddenly, A bright light came towards him, and in the light stood a messenger. The messenger held a book in his hand and spoke to Sentaro. "I am sent to you by Jofuku, who, in answer to your prayer, has permitted you, in a dream, to see the land of perpetual life. But you grew weary of living there, and begged to be allowed to return to your native land so that you might die. Jofuku, so that he might try you, allowed you to drop into the sea and then sent a shark to swallow you up. Your desire for death was not real, for even at that moment you cried out loudly and shouted for help. It is also in vain for you to wish to become a hermit or to find the elixir of life. These things are not for such as you. Your life is not austere enough. It is best for you to go back to your paternal home and to live a good and industrious life. Never neglect to keep the anniversary of your ancestors and make it your duty to provide for your children's future. Thus, will you live to a good old age and be happy. But give up the vain desire to escape death, for no man can do that. And by this time, you have surely found out that even when selfish desires are granted, they do not bring happiness. In this book I give you, there are many precepts good for you to know. If you study them, you will be guided in a way I have pointed out to you." The angel disappeared as soon as he had finished speaking, and Sentaro took the lesson to heart. With the book in his hand, he returned to his old home, and giving up all his old vain wishes, tried to live a good and useful life and to observe the lessons taught him in the book, and he and his house prospered henceforth. One of the questions that I received from a couple of listeners is, why did Jofuku never return? While the character appears in a fairy tale, he was a real person. A Chinese alchemist and explorer named Xu Fu. My apologies for pronunciation. When the first emperor of Qin dynasty entrusted him with the task to find elixir of life, he set sail but never returned from the trip. A little history search on the Wikipedia provide couple of possible explanations. For example, the record of the Grand Historian, something that has been called a foundational text in Chinese civilization, finished around 94 BC, says he came to a place with flat plains and wide swamps and proclaimed himself king, never to return. Another reason, perhaps because he knew that if they returned without the promised elixir, they would surely be executed. Legends claim that he reached Japan and colonized it. In much later Japanese text, however, Shu is said to have brought new farming techniques and knowledge, introduced many new plants that improved the quality of the life of ancient Japanese people. The local worship of Shu Fu as the god of farming, god of medicine, and god of silk by the Japanese is attributed to these achievements. So basically, there is no clear motivation that I can find, and the reasons change based on where you look. I like to think that Jofuku had similar experiences as Sentaro, and due to this reason, he chose this method to teach Sentaro the true contentment. But that's my imagination. Now back to memory. Once again, I would request you to please check out the previous two episodes if you haven't already. Here is a quick recap. In a small town in India, during my late teenage years, I grew concerned with the limited potential of career growth, and even with the financial limitations, joined two fellow students to move to a bigger city to chase my dreams of a fabulous career. With initial challenges of language and the whole new world, we were getting better. Let's jump right back into the memory. Thank you. After few more months, days started to feel heavy. I was tired. The day-to-day challenges were not something I was prepared for, nor did I expect a successful career journey to be this mentally taxing. Amusing things turned into depressing affairs. For example, the tiffin service would only deliver feast on Saturdays and no food on Sunday. They abused the word feast as it was only lunch and no dinner with subpar food, which was not exciting to begin with during the week. We ended up walking to central bus stand of the city to find places with cheaper food options. There were shops which would serve 12 puris, a fried Indian bread, with unlimited curry for a mere 10 rupees. We would devour the curry like maniacs while the servers looked at us in shock as we were a bunch of unusual patrons. As much as we wanted to forget, the paltry monthly budget left us with no choice but rely on these places, and by the time the month ends, sometimes skipping meals on weekends. In addition, all subjects started requiring more study to wrap our brains around deeper concepts. Class tests, an eventual deadline to appear for the exam, was coming up silently but rapidly. On top of that, Rocky decided that he is now going to be living with his brother as his brother's roommate fled. He left us in a matter of hours. It was traumatic. Even for the fair reasons, his decision stung us really bad. In that time, it felt like a betrayal. We would still meet him daily at the classes, but the spark of our friendship had died. This vacancy, however, was filled rather quickly by another roommate who was a fellow student at the academy. But he was not Rocky. Just like always, all the challenges and trouble looked exciting in the beginning, but remaining focused on the goal with all these seemingly worrisome distractions was too much. On some weekends, I would go to my hometown carrying a heavy bag of clothes for laundry, and those 2 days I felt much more relaxed. My friends, who remained in hometown, would come to meet me as someone who earned respect for chasing a career. They would ask me to share stories of this amazing life in Indore. They would confide in me, "It's good that you left this town, as there is no future here." And in that, they sounded just like a version of myself from a few months ago. I wanted to tell them that what they think is a good thing is not how I come to see it, but I lacked courage to tell them. I couldn't carry the burden of disappointing them. I would come back to Indore heavy-hearted, knowing I'm not being honest to my family and friends, the people who care about me more than my career. And above all, I was not being honest with myself, and I had a lot of trouble dealing with this reality. I was not alone in this dilemma. The backbenchers had few members coming to terms with this reality too. Even the slightest nuances, like class schedule changes, were being met with statements like, "This is it, I'm going back home." After a lot of debate, weighing pros and cons, we all agreed that all of us will return home as soon as this batch is over. We paid for the batch and we have to get our money's worth here. We just have 6 more weeks. We also agreed to stay in touch with every friend and come back to Indore for the exam in December. The schedule for the last 3 weeks of the batch was in our hand now. It included an announcement of an annual function with dance, plays, and food to celebrate the successful conclusion of this batch. Of course, it was a paid event. The backbenchers decided to spring for it, as it will be our swan song and an end to this misguided journey. The day of the event had a different meaning to all of us. To me, it felt like a grand and elaborate goodbye than a celebration of a successful batch. Next day, we all went back to our homes, and none of us returned for the exam. let's start with some parallels. In part 1, Sentaro, just like me, was not happy with the current state of his life and embarked on the journey without much clarity of the purpose. In part 2, both me and Sentaro were mesmerized and amused with the destination that we wanted to reach, regardless of its unusual specialities. In part 3, I was a failure and a disappointment for my family and close friend, just like Sentaro was disappointed with the life in the country of perpetual life. For years, I kept blaming other things, primarily insufficient budget, but as the time matured, I realized I did not mentally prepare for it, rushed into decision, and I lacked focus, which is a basic ingredient for anything you want to do right. But when you do the right things for wrong reasons, sooner or later, they almost always produce wrong results. As the messenger said, when selfish desires are granted, they do not bring happiness. At first, Sentaro expected to be happy in the country of perpetual life, but then he learns that it does not satisfy him. Similarly, our life in Indore started off really strong, but soon became unbearable. Just like Sentaro, who learns to be content with his life and the death he will face at the end of it, I also found my family and friends to be the true source of joy, at least in that period. Sometimes the best, most teachable moments came from failure, and I'm glad I got to fail in this instance. But this experience helped me more in my career than I ever expected. A quote I frequently refer to, which is sometimes attributed to Albert Einstein, but in fact originated with sociologist William Bruce Cameron's 1963 text, Informal Sociology, A Casual Introduction to Sociological Thinking. Not everything that can be counted counts, and not everything that counts can be counted. It basically means not everything that can be counted is important, and not everything that is important can be counted. This concludes this mini-series and this episode. Hope you enjoyed it. Please share your thoughts on this series by leaving a review on awalkwithinpodcast.com. It really helps and is much appreciated. You can also follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. All links are available in show notes. Please keep a close eye on these social channels, especially in the upcoming weeks, for a special announcement and some cool giveaways. Once again, I wanted to thank all the listeners for continuing to support the show. Till next time, stay as awesome as you are.